You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this Huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. Hey everybody, after a longer than expected break, we're finishing up our energy justice season with a conversation with some of the brains and hearts behind Ho'ahu Energy Cooperative Molokai. When we started this podcast last year, we chose the name Root Cause Remedies because we liked the idea of understanding the historical roots of a problem, the present day causes, and ways we could remedy these big issues. Over this season, we've been delving into energy justice, starting at the roots of Hawaiian Electric's monopoly and the dubious history of its founder, and moving on to the present day ways that this continued corporate control impacts Hawaii's energy landscape. In episode 2 and 3, we got to hear from Kahuku Kia'i, who talked about some of the systemic structures of inequality and extraction that led to their decision to stand against energy injustice in their community through nonviolent direct action. Today, we get to spend time on the remedies part because we're joined by Lori Buchanan, Todd Yamashita, Christopher O'Brien, and Ali Andrews, who will be telling us about their work to form a community-owned and community-driven renewable energy cooperative on Molokai. They're part of a hui that will be submitting a proposal for a utility-scale solar project to Hawaiian Electric's community-based renewable energy initiative. But they want to do it right. Ho'ahu is made up of community members, and they're serious about making sure that the people of Molokai shape the project from start to finish and collectively reap its benefits. It's a heavy undertaking, but a pretty transformative one, and it gives us a peek into a future in which Hawaii's energy is not only renewable, but also decentralized and community-owned. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to hear your story. For the listeners, we've already done round one of interviews, but we're going to redo it. Todd, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourselves, and then we can go through everyone else?
Sure. My name is Todd Yamashita, and I am president of Oahu Energy Cooperative Molokai. And yeah, I'm the fourth generation from my family here on Molokai. My kids are the fifth. And actually, my background in my family, my grandfather was president of Molokai Electric, and then my father followed in his footsteps before the company was sold to HECO. So energy is a little bit in my background, but I come from a background of fine arts, and I also own the Molokai Dispatch, and I work in conservation with monk seals here on Molokai. And what else do I do? Let's see. That's about it. Yeah.
Aloha, everybody. I'm Auntie Lori Buchanan. I think I'm the kupuna on this board, and they gave me the title of vice president. So I feel really important. But I'm born and raised Molokai. We'll be here forever. I am mother of 8 and grandma to 21 children. I consider myself a community advocate, but I hold a lot of hats, just like Todd, because just by virtue of being older, I guess I have a little bit more hats than him. I have a regular job, and that's coordinating the invasive species committee here on the island of Molokai. So yes, I am a conservationist. If you want to make titles. I'm also a small business owner. My husband and I have a couple of small businesses of Molokai, and I've had several opportunities to serve my community on statewide boards and commissions, as well as county, and then also on a national level with the Invasive Species Council in Washington, D.C. So everything is based on aloha aina and wanting to do our responsibility as a native Hawaiian, which I am, to take care of aina, because aina takes care of us. And I totally believe in that reciprocal love relationship between our environment and us as human people. So that is, for me, transitioning into forming the cooperative. The energy cooperative was really a natural path because of the importance to community and the environment. And that's why I'm here. So thank you for having me.
Mahalo. Can't wait to hear more.
Hi, my name is Christopher O'Brien. I'm the treasurer for the co-op. My background is I'm actually from the North Shore on Oahu. I moved here because my kids' mom and their family are longtime generational residents here on Molokai, and they're Hawaiian homesteaders. My background is also in a degrees in writing and political science, a master's in accounting and a law degree. I have a small business that specializes in providing nonprofit accounting and compliance and grant writing services. My full-time job is director of admin and development at Sustainable Molokai, where I'm kind of like a chief administrative officer and financial officer for the organization, and really got into energy through my work at Sustainable Molokai. And then I joined the co-op and since then have been helping to push forward renewable energy on the island.
I'm Allie Andrews. I run a community solar company called Shake Energy Collaborative. We're a public benefits corporation, women-owned renewable energy developer. Started a couple of years ago, a little less than 2 years ago now, out of a grad school research project around community engagement and community decision-making in the energy industry. I really learned most of what I learned in grad school from a lot of the people on this call. Classes were great, but the biggest learns were to go out and learn from actual community engaging in that design process. And I have been working with people on Molokai for probably 2 or 3 years now, since 2018, but we've been working on this project specifically for a little over a year now.
Okay, I feel like I'm going to learn a lot from this interview because we've been talking a lot about kind of like what's wrong with our energy system here in Hawaii. And it's oftentimes easy to point out the problems, but really hard to wrap your head around solutions. I'm hoping you can help me with that. I'm curious about how you folks started working on energy justice and energy injustice in Molokai. Like, what was the impetus for that?
How far back do you want to go?
Well, maybe to your grandpa.
I honestly would love to start the conversation at the fact that, you know, Hawaii went through this brilliant cultural renaissance in the 70s. And I'm so grateful to come from this island that has always been really focused on aloha aina, really focused on, you know, protecting our natural spaces and the resources here. And, you know, this island and its steadfast leaders have always, you know, supported, you know, this movement, you know, to safeguard the things that we have. I really feel like, you know, Molokai has always, you know, because of that generation that's really pushed back and that's really fought for the culture and fought for the environment and the community, I would describe Molokai as being reactive. You know, it's a small place, the small population, and we've been bombarded over the years with outside interests coming in and trying to do what they've wanted to do here. The past 10 years on Molokai has actually been relatively quiet in terms of no big conspiracies per se, you know, not forcing us to really react. And instead of just, you know, sitting back and trying to take care of the business and just literally trying to make a living here and get by with ourselves and our families, I really give our community a ton of credit because during this time of relative peace and quiet, they've continued to be focused on community leadership, on safeguarding water, on safeguarding land, safeguarding our, you know, our coastlines and everything else. And I have to put credit where credit is due. And that generation that Auntie Lori can definitely speak more detailed about, you know, that's where we owe our direction from, is this values-based aloha aina kind of spirit.
I guess that was a segue from Todd. I had to go back and I heard what you said, Tina. You said, what's wrong with this? And my knee-jerk reaction is always, what's wrong with it is that we don't own it. And because we don't own it, we have little to no say in how our communities are impacted by large corporations, basically not owned by the people of the state of Hawaii. And if they are for profit, which leaves little room for us to include, from at least my perspective, on the Maka'i Nana grassroots level of how I am being impacted on the ground and how my environment around me is being impacted. And we know on the 30,000 view level that the use of fossil fuels and other energy systems have really depleted our resources and been an engine for climate change. And so as practitioners, we really have to have control over how energy is used especially here on the island of Molokai, because we just have to. And so now's the time for us to try and capture control of how we can not be impacted and how we can be sustainable and move forward in the energy field. If we're not driving the car, then we're being dragged by the car. And that's not a good scenario to be in. And so that's really why we formed with like-minded people, with really Aloha Aina as the base, and then moving out from there. So, and Chris is a really vital part of that too, Chris. And I love this guy. He's wicked smart. Go ahead, Chris.
And I think where we are at now is working not just on Molokai's energy future, but also networking with other communities like ours, small communities that typically get left out of the process and things are done without their input. And because we were organized well in advance and pretty systematic about it, these communities are looking at us as sort of a role model on how to lead the way forward. And I think for me, us setting that path is exciting because we have people who have been working on this for like years and years and years. And now we're putting our foot in the ring and saying we're gonna push it forward. And we're gonna do it in a way that actually benefits the community. And it is not for profit, and it is for the profit of the community.
Okay, that's so awesome. And I'm hearing like super big ideas connecting this work to the work of previous generations and that Aloha Aina resistance and regeneration. And it kind of reminds me of like something that one of the Kahuku Kia'i said, Te Vita Ka'ili, about how energy becomes about putting us into relationship with Aina. But then I'm also curious, like for people like say here on Oahu who've never heard about what you folks are doing, can you give me like a little snapshot of what has that actually looked like for you? How did you decide on making it a cooperative? How did you connect with Shake Energy? That kind of thing.
I'm just going to kick this off. I'll start the first part of the story and I'll let Ali follow up. But I had the awesome opportunity for working with the Polynesian Voyaging Society, voyaging on Hokulea, but you know, also doing some of the important work that they do behind the scenes to keep the voyages going. And you know, it was during the worldwide voyage, and you know, it was just a waterfall of work. And we had to reach out for help and hire some interns. And Ali was actually one of our hires and was one of the best people that I've had the pleasure of working with. You know, she dropped that job and she actually went back to school to get a design degree in energy and just said, "Hey, Todd, I'm doing this cool stuff. And what do you think about energy? And I got to do a project. Where should I go?" And I said, "Well, you know, Molokai is a cool place. And the cost of electricity is also, you know, one of the highest in the nation. So it could make for some very interesting work." Anyway, Ali, I'll let you take the rest of the story.
I would say my path joining into this long flow of energy advocacy, multi-generational work that has been happening on Molokai. I was very lucky to get to join into that flow at the time that I did, at the time that I was really forming what I think that I want to do with my time and what I think a company should be doing with their time in terms of how energy companies should be operating in the world. So I think in 2018 was when I was trying to figure out where's an environment outside of classroom where I can learn about where the rubber meets the road. How do communities get their voice into this infrastructure development that historically has just been a bunch of engineers and financiers in a room deciding what happens and then maybe telling people about it later or maybe not and just building it and being like, "You're welcome." Yeah. So I think that was very lucky. That was in 2018. There was a different project that was being worked on and I got to be a volunteer and help learn from and co-host some workshops with a really awesome leader in the energy advocacy space on Molokai at the time, Amelia Nordhook, who was working for Sustainable Molokai. And then it was a year ago in March of 2020, like the last weekend before everything shut down because of the pandemic, we had an in-person workshop and said, "Take two, okay, this is a new project. This is a new company." My company had just been formed 6 months prior and the community really expressed like, "Yes, we still really want a project under this policy called CBRE, Community-Based Renewable Energy." And the previous project had sort of hit some roadblocks, had stopped. We needed to reinvent what it was that it could look like. And we started from there. And I think one of the most important things the community members emphasized was community ownership. which was something that the previous project wasn't thinking about. A lot of other projects are not thinking about, and that is a heavy lift, because in order to own it locally, you have to have an entity that can own it locally. That's where the conversation started about how do we form a cooperative? Who knows about forming a cooperative? I don't. And we were lucky enough to find Teresa Young at the Kohala Center out of Waimea on Big Island. She started meeting with us over Zoom to help us draft articles of incorporation and bylaws. And what kind of board members do we need? And yeah, maybe I'll pause it there. Who else wants to pick up the thread?
Hi, this is Auntie Laurie. As a born and raised Molokai person and being raised during a time when there was what Tog talked about, like the Renaissance, there's always been passion and a fire and a desire and an innate knowledge that we all had that responsibility and kuleana to take care of our environment, right? Because culturally, as an Indigenous person, we do believe that the land is the chief and we the servants. And so that paradigm, you know, tip over, and that in all the things that we do, we try to place the effects to the environment first, because we know that in the end, we are dependent on those environments. So we've always had that passion here on Molokai. But what we were lacking, and I really have to give props to Sustainable Molokai at this point, because it was really Sustainable Molokai and the great people that started working for Sustainable Molokai that kind of hooked me into this field of energy, because actually we don't know nothing about energy and the complexities of the puzzles and all of these pieces come together. But we had the fire and the passion. And so Sustainable Molokai is an entity brought these really smart people together, and Ali and Emilia Nordholt. What we got was someone that was passionate, like-minded, mission-driven as we were. But most importantly, they were there to listen to the community, not talk to the community, but to actually listen and really feel what we felt and how we wanted to proceed. And so she bought the technical part, and then all the pieces of the puzzle just came together, and that light bulb went on, and we all said, we can do this. We can do this. Every community can do this. We love to set precedents. We love to empower other grassroots communities to form and take control of the places where they live. And this is what Ali gave us, was that opportunity to bring all the pieces of the puzzle together. It's just been an exciting, nonstop ride, because pretty soon you will find 100 people that want to jump into your car and they want to take that ride with you. And it's really a heartwarming experience for me as a grassroots community advocate, always fighting for our community, to find out that there's a lot of people out there, not Hawaiian, from every place of the world that wants to help you to do that.
And I would add that we decided to go with the co-op model because it appealed to us in the way that it was structured. Co-ops are kind of like a quasi nonprofit type of organization. They're not completely nonprofit, but all of the, what you would quote, call a profit goes back to the members. In this case, we envision our members being the community itself. So really it's going to flow back into the community. And in forming this co-op, we went, like I've helped to form a lot of organizations, nonprofits, regular LLCs and regular businesses in general. But this is the first co-op that I ever participated in helping to form. And so for me, it was also an opportunity to learn about how to incorporate a co-op and how to do it successfully. And for us, we see this co-op structure as the way to bring the maximum benefit of these energy projects back into the community. Unlike other organizations or some for-profit entities, we actually are prioritizing different metrics than just profit in terms of what we give back to the community. And so part of those elements are like workforce development, education, environmental concerns, cultural concerns. And so as a co-op, we can build that in to the way that we operate and go forward.
That's so cool. Okay, so like Auntie Laurie said, I feel like Molokai loves to set a precedent, and like everybody kind of looks to Molokai because you have such a tight-knit community and such an active community. So it makes sense that this co-op model would work there, that you have the kind of relationships that enable that. But what does that actually look like? And I'm especially curious about what Auntie Laurie was saying about, you know, not a lot of people know a lot about energy. So how do you give the community the tools to take ownership?
You know, to me, it really comes down to, again, talking about resources, because everyone has Molokai at the center of their hearts when they do all the things that they do here. To me, energy is kind of like, sure, it's an unknown thing for a lot of people. But if you start talking about, okay, well, what does it mean that the sun shines on this community, on all of us at the same time? What does it mean that, you know, the winds that have Hawaiian names blow on everybody through the community, through, you know, our shared landscapes? When we start talking about these elements in nature that we have been trying our best to steward and safeguard, and you talk about, is there some kind of a reciprocal element that can be shared there? I think it makes total sense, you know, to the people who live here. We have that close relationship with those elements. We have that dialogue with those elements. And so for us, or for myself, I guess, you know, I try to start our conversations there about this thing that we all love about Molokai.
You know, and I would add, you know, yeah, we're a tight-knit community in a lot of ways, but that doesn't mean we're always in 100% agreement. You know, disagreements do happen. And part of what we tried to do, and I think we've been very good at, is bringing all that feedback together and trying to find a path that everybody can agree is the best path forward for us. I think for other communities, you know, one of the things that I've tried to emphasize is that, you know, this way that we're organizing can be done anywhere. All they need to do is bring together a group of committed people as the core and then start to engage the community around the issues. But, you know, like none of us, I think, on the board, except for our secretary, I think have a lot of energy background. What we do have is a lot of competencies in a lot of different areas. We have a lot of community organizing experience. And for us, you know, we're learning a lot about getting into some of the details about energy as we go through this process. At the end of the day, you don't need to have like engineers a part of the process in the beginning. You just need people from the community to stand up and say, look, we need to take control, because if we don't take control and step up and develop our own projects, we're always going to be having somebody outside coming to us and us just being reactionary.
I was just going to add and maybe also challenge a little bit what Auntie Lori said about not being the expert. I think that this process has really shown me, and that was like a thesis question that as a student, I was like, I think that renewable energy development companies will be better situated, will actually benefit from community input because they know more about local place, they know more about their community. So subscription design is going to be a lot better and easier and well designed. Like, I think that yes, there are some external experts that we have brought to the table that have very excitedly come to the table to bring their services because everyone loves to be involved in this project. But I think the same is true of an energy development company. Most energy developers are also not engineers. They may be subcontract to an engineer. Maybe they have an engineer on their team. But I have learned so much about energy development from these guys on this call. Todd wires his own systems on his roof and for his friends' roofs. And Auntie Lori knows literally everything about every parcel on Molokai. So like finding a site was way easier because we could just screen share in our Zoom workshop on site selection. And she'd be like, no, that part is owned by this person. This part is owned by this person. Let's go talk to that person. And so I think that by exporting those decisions out back to the community, it was a lot faster and easier. And I think a lot, we're going to have the competitive advantage because we've got that place-based knowledge in our design.
And like Auntie Lori always says, I love repeating this one, but she always says, hey, you know, it's not rocket science. And really, if you think about it, the RFP calls for a 2.75 megawatt solar field with battery backup storage, and it's parked right next to the utility. And this is definitely something we can wrap our minds around. We've surrounded ourselves with professionals to help us achieve. Yeah, I think the overall message here is that this is attainable for even small communities like ours, for sure.
Okay, since you mentioned the RFP, I want to get a little bit into like the relationship with HECO. You also, Ali, mentioned the community-based renewables program. So what does that relationship look like? What does the RFP look like?
I would say, okay, so CBRE, Community-Based Renewable Energy, is a policy that was initiated by, I think it was Act 100 back in 2014 or 2015, where the legislature said, we will have ways for people without access to rooftop solar to join in the benefits of solar, which in a lot of other places, it's called community solar. In Hawaii, they called it community-based renewable energy, which I think is really great and reflective of the the idea that it's not just a transaction or a community scale project. It is based in community, rooted in community decision making, or it should be. Historically, it has not been, but I think that is the best version of it itself. It's a policy that has been live for a few years, since 2018. And the first phase of the project was relatively unsuccessful in building projects that actually enabled residential customers to access benefits. I think so far, no projects have actually come online that you can subscribe to. And even the ones who have gone as far down that development path really were more intentioned towards serving commercial customers, because that's sort of the easier way to do it from the industry perspective, get a couple of big commercial customers rather than all this messy community work and recruiting individual customers. More recently, that program closed, and the second program, the second phase of CBRE launched last summer, phase two, which is enormous, so much bigger. The first phase was 8 megawatts. The second, across the state, the second phase is going to be 230 megawatts, I think, across the state. So they're just blowing it up and hoping that people can do a better job of engaging residential customers and hopefully also engaging community members in the design of projects. And I'll stop there.
Auntie Lori, could you maybe talk about Molokai's relationship with the utility?
Oh, that could be pretty. Maybe you can put it a little bit more eloquently, Todd Yamashita, you know, because you know what Auntie Lori thinks? When I hear the word RFP and HECO, I refer to it as the shell game. You know, from the practitioner's perspective and from me as a community person, the discussion, like you just heard from Ellie, tends to be so complex and so overboard that the normal person, all they begin to hear is blah, blah, blah. And I dove deep into it because I knew that this community was basically being ripped off and that large contracts for energy was being put out by the utility without a public request for proposal, and giving what I thought that local energy companies, not necessarily even our co-op, which we were not formed at that time, the opportunity to participate in providing energy to communities. Being an advocate on Molokai, I've always felt like I was somebody's dinner, that somebody was always drooling, looking at me and my resources and how they was going to devour me for their own self-gain. And so I began to educate myself in the field of energy. And so it didn't take long, because you see a shell game when you do, and you know that you're on the losing side. And so I advocated with the utility, and I was hoping that that's probably why we at this CBRE junction in all of our lives, because finally they heard. But we're still not there, because the RFPs that are currently going out are still very, although they're much, much better and they do include the community, there's so much more out there that has to come online, and it really needs to go back to the drawing board in order to have a level playing field for everybody. You know, for us as a community, we didn't have the technical expertise, but guess what? I know how to hire the expertise. So I'm smart enough to do that. And working with people, if we all share the same vision and mission, then we can do it. That's how I, at least I felt about our relationship with them. Utility.
Thanks, Auntie Lori. You know, to me, it's kind of like a triangle, right? On one side, you have the utility. On the other side, you have the customer. And in Hawaii, because of our geographical location, we have one utility. And so on the other side of that triangle, you have the PUC. You know, if you just look at that, you know, it's the utility is a publicly traded company, you know, it's profit-driven corporate, all of that stuff. So if you just look at that, you know, the way the structure is built alone, you know, that's a really contentious thing that's made for friction. And if you look at energy up to this point, especially on Molokai, especially here in Hawaii, the missing point of that triangle has been the community. I think that for us and for the PUC to want to hear more from the community, instead of the community being at the back end of that process, having us more towards the front end of that process, I think that if we can succeed here, you know, we can go a long ways in kind of balancing that out and maybe hopefully moving some of that, removing some of that tension and that friction that's in that process.
You know, we are a very new organization. We just formally incorporated it this year. And so in terms of talking about the co-op itself, its relationship to HECO, it's a very nascent thing. One thing we have been active about is filing our thoughts with the PUC about the RFPs that we're interested in, and also in meeting with the Molokai Clean Energy Hui and meeting with one of the PUC commissioners already and discussing some of these issues that we have. You know, like there is distrust definitely in the community, but one of the things we know going forward is that if we want to make this RFP process for our community on a level playing field, that's going to involve working closely with HECO, and also at the same time making sure that we're going out and gathering information that will support our position, which we have wonderful partners helping us doing.
Okay, so you've only recently incorporated, and this is my own ignorance showing. So you're submitting a proposal to the community-based renewable energy program with Hawaiian Electric, and then it's on Hawaiian Electric to choose which proposals to essentially support. I've also read confusing things about Hawaiian Electric's self-build project, and I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about it, but when you submit a proposal and it goes through that competitive process, what happens when then Hawaiian Electric is also, in a sense, competing with you folks? Doesn't quite make sense.
To us either. Our position from day one has been that the self-build option shouldn't even be an option. What we found, or what we believe, is that their inclusion in the process and them being allowed to participate is actually making the RFP worse, the RFP that's being produced by HECO. Because right now, the current version of the RFP of RFPs that we see have terms that so favorably benefit only the self-build team, and by extension, HECO, because you always remember the self-build team is HECO. You know, they just have a supposed firewall separating the two of them. And so that's one of the things we've been advocating for, which is trying to get the self-build option removed, especially in communities where there are developers that are publicly stating they're interested in developing projects.
In an ideal world, the self-build function is sort of to provide another option to make sure that whatever is submitted to the bid is a competitive bid. In theory, it's a level playing field and it increases competition, so it holds us accountable to coming in at the lowest price that we possibly can, which, as you have probably heard from this conversation, like, that is already a motivation. We are a community-based project. There is no side deal that if, you know, we'll bid high so that we can siphon the profits off. Like, the profits are all going to stay on the island through the cooperative. That frustrates us a little bit, as well as the terms that Chris mentioned, that it's been challenging to see those. They write the rules for who wins, and they also pick who wins, and they compete against it too.
What we've also found is that instead of driving competition, the self-build option is actually reducing it. When we were going through our process of selecting, you know, our development partner, in addition to Shake Energy, we had like a very huge national energy company pull out. They were one of our finalists. It was after they found out the self-build team was competing. In their opinion, there was no way they could compete against the self-build team. There were too many things built in place that would benefit the self-build team that competing would not make sense for them. And so in terms of other developers, like non-co-op developers even being interested, they're not, you know, like we haven't seen any other outside developers besides the co-op coming to the community. And I think the self-build option plays a major role in that.
So shifting gears a little bit, big picture question. Our podcast team has been learning a lot about energy justice and ideas like procedural justice and distributive justice. The key thing that I've heard in our conversation is that really, like, this is about ownership. Like Auntie Lori said, the problem is we don't own it. And you could say that about so many things in Hawaii. You can say that about Hawaii itself. I'm wondering if you can talk to me about energy sovereignty, because you're attempting to take full control, power, and it sounds also like your relationship to energy and our natural resources, to Aina itself. Can you kind of share a little bit of that vision? Is that a conversation that you folks have?
I just gonna say one thing super fast. Resource sovereignty is sovereignty. A friend of mine and I had a conversation a little while back, and he busted that one out.
Well, Todd, that's it.
It's not rocket science.
I know you guys are gonna take up the rest of the conversation. Wow. That was just, you know, planting the seed right there.
Wow, this is Auntie Lori. You know, ownership, sovereignty, and all that, at the base and core for me is oppression. That's it. In every way, shape, or form, oppression to people and the environment. It doesn't benefit anyone, anything at any time. And to sit back and let oppression in any form continue is something that I cannot stomach. And, you know, whatever word you want to call it sovereignty, ownership, whatever you want to do, oppression needs to stop on every level. And so whatever we can do, in this case, energy oppression, because the people of Molokai, for all of my life on Molokai, I have paid the highest electrical costs per kilowatt hour in the entire nation of the United States of America. And we are one of the poorest community in Hawaii. And that's oppression. And we're oppressed because, again, we don't have control over our use of energy resources on the island of Molokai. We have a utility that is a publicly traded utility for profit. The co-op we formed is with the intent to go back and benefit the company. All of the board members currently now are all volunteers, and we're driven by heart. And earlier you asked about how do grassroots communities get there? How do we do this? As a community advocate on all my life, working for my community, I've learned to try to explain very complex issues, whether they were undersea cables, windmills, cruise ships, rocket launching pads, monotypic GMO crop, Department of Defense training, you name it. My community trusts me and all of us to act on their behalf with truth, transparency, honesty, and genuine love and care for our neighbors. So oppression, we just have to. It's not if you should or you must, if you're not smart enough to do this. We called to do it. We have to do it. And so that's why we're here.
Another core thing about any type of sovereignty, but especially energy sovereignty, is self-determination. And that is what the whole process of engaging the community is all about. Because once the community can be brought together and to give voice to what they see as their goals, their values, their mission, and then be able to effectuate that, that's what self-determination is. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's the way that we've set up our process, is to effectuate that.
I would also add that as an observer and a base maker for this community decision-making process and seeing that evolve and seeing more people come to the table and want to come to the table and learn what the decisions are and how they can give input, that has been a truly inspiring thing to watch happen and to see. The Molokai people are the best people to be making decisions about those resources. They're going to steward them in the best ways. They're going to be the most financially reasonable, they're going to be the most environmentally respectful and culturally respectful and respectful of their neighbors and community. They're in the best position to make that decision. And our the structural oppression, the structural racism of the energy industry is, I think, a lot of the reason that we are in this climate change pickle that we find ourselves in, where we're sort of like, it's really hard to move this really big juggernaut towards renewable energy because we were doing it this way and it's built for fossil fuels. But if we can find more ways to break down the decision making down to the people who are best suited to be making those decisions, I personally think that we can rewrite the script on climate change and on our future. If that is what has been like really powerful for me to watch from these guys.
For people who listen to this conversation and feel really excited about what you've been talking about, what advice do you have as like first steps for people to take this kind of action? And also, what do they stand to gain? Because I feel like we look at this problem and it seems so intimidating, like so much work, but it also, like, I can see your faces on this Zoom and you get really excited talking about it. Taking responsibility in this way also stands to provide a lot of benefit, not just to your community, but to your actual life and the relationships that you have with the people around you and with the land and resources around you too.
I would first recommend that if there are other listeners and communities that are interested, reach out to Ali. Ali already has a lot of experience working with us on how to start engaging the community with these conversations. And Ali has always been really great at making that space for the community to have the primary voice in the room. And in fact, she's already helping a group in Waianae embark on the same pathway that we're going forward on. And then in each community, it's about finding people with the passion to go forward and to realize, yes, this is intimidating. And, you know, sometimes when I sit back and I think about how big this could potentially be, like we're talking about millions of dollars that will be flowing through, and we have the opportunity to make it flow into as much pockets of our community residents. That might not be the case with another outside developer. And so it's okay to be intimidated. I think anybody in their right mind would be, but realizing that, you know, it's possible, you know, you take it in bite-sized chunks. And for us, it's always looking at, okay, what is it that we need to get done? What is on our agenda? And we just tackle each of those issues as we go through. But yeah, it's okay to be intimidated, but you have to take the first step and you have to reach out to people. Even us as a co-op, you know, we've gone and met with other communities. So we're also willing to help. We really know that the success of our community means success for all of the other communities throughout the state. And we're willing to be here to help lead and network and partner with.
Alika has some homework now.
Yeah, best homework ever. These guys, that was really nice. I would absolutely love to help anyone who is thinking about that, figure out what their options are and who else they can reach out to. I would echo what Auntie Lori said about, like, once we started this process, the number of people who flooded in who wanted to help us, from lawyers to cooperative development specialists, to community members, to engineers, to interconnection engineers. Like, everybody sees the need for this and just is looking for people who are willing to take the first step.
And just don't be afraid, you know, it's like the learning curve is not steep. You know, you find that you start to get into energy and it really is, it's interesting stuff. It's really engaging. I say that because we all started from humble beginnings and it did take us many years to get to where we are. So, but with a community advocate, with somebody that is there to be the glue, to help bring people together like Ali, that, you know, don't necessarily have a stake in the outcome, those things can greatly speed up and clarify the process for the community. And I'm saying these things though, because there is an urgency. These CBREs are coming out all over Hawaii. And the message that the talk that we're having with our community is, you know, 50% of Molokai's energy needs is up for grabs right now, right? There's actually two RFPs. The CBRE is only, you know, part of what's available. If we don't get a crack at this, if we don't jump in and try to do our best to take a piece of this for our community, we're not going to have another shot at this for 20 years. It might be a little scary to jump into something like this. Like Chris said, like Ali said, we're here not just to serve our community, but to serve everybody. And if you guys like come copy and paste all the stuff we did, no problem.
I appreciate that. Like, that sense of urgency, it's so important that we remember, and not just in terms of like the CBRE process, but just in terms of climate change in general, like, we got to do this now. I guess the last question, because you guys are on the ground dealing with all of these like really complicated realities, I really like to end our podcast by giving people space to like fully let their imaginations run wild. So Chris was saying, like, sometimes it sinks in how big this could be in terms of what a big responsibility it could be if this all works out. But I also want to let you run with that, how big it could be in terms of the impact. So, like, in your wildest dreams, where does this take you? Like, where does this take Molokai's energy landscape? What does Molokai's energy landscape look like 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road when energy sovereignty becomes a reality?
I don't know, maybe some people might talk about going forward and, you know, what the new energy environment looks like and how much accessibility it's bringing to communities like ours. For me, I look back, you know, I mentioned my grandfather, you know, being the president of Molokai Electric, and he wasn't known as an engineer or an electrical guy. He was known as a community man, you know, and I remember back then, I remember our community, a lot more people having jobs and there was a lot going on. And, you know, the utility at that point had a really big stake in a community, you know, and they really helped support all of the community building that was going on here. And for me, just personally, I can speak for myself, you know, that's the type of spirit that I want to carry forward for my community. That's my goal.
I would say for me, there's a couple of different things that I see in my head when I think of the vision, which is one where the energy costs have been driven so low. I don't think this is going to happen within 10 to 20 years. Maybe we can get there, but the energy costs are no longer this huge financial burden on Molokai families, because it is a huge burden. And then, but I also have a vision, and we've talked about it as a co-op, of the community being able to engage with these projects that are on the ground. And so that includes, you know, potentially developing mixed use sites where agriculture can exist around solar or other renewable energy technology. And at the same time, a place where the community can come and learn about energy and participate in the energy future and to learn about it in general. Nati Lori, I know you have something good, so I'll point it over to you.
No, I don't have nothing good. No, I just like everything free, like that commercial, free, 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 free. But I'm cognizant that my trouble is, if you want to give something for free, that person who is receiving that item or that freebie really has to know what the responsibility for that is. And just because you get something for free doesn't mean you are going to abuse that. Like any other type of freedom, you never would abuse that, or else that freedom gets taken away. The same with energy. If I offer my neighbors a very low cost of energy per kilowatt hour, I expect them to incorporate all of the saving efforts they did if they paid 1 cent versus $1,000 per kilowatt. That is part of just being responsible as a human. And so I'm very cognizant of that at all times. And so that needs to go hand in hand. If we're using the resources and we're taking care of our resources, then there's no reason why that shouldn't be free. I don't want a for-profit company driving energy or anything else in our community, because looking to the past and going future, yeah, in the past, everybody was able to employ themselves by taking care of each other and the neighbors. And even if we started to do microgrids tomorrow and being off the grid, there would still be people that we would need to call and depend on to fix all of our utilities, like Todd is doing right now, that had the expertise to keep us going. And then again, also being very real with the responsibility that comes along with all of that freedom. So that's it.
I'm glad you brought up the microgrids, because I know we've been talking mainly about the CBRE RFP, and that is a utility scale project. I think one of the things that we've expressed concern about, and because there's a CBRE RFP that's out, there's also a non-CBRE about to come out. We call it the Pala'au RFP. And our concern is that the way that they're structured is that it centralizes both projects in the Pala'au area. And for us, we feel that's a dangerous centralization, because, you know, as Todd has said often in our meetings, just a little bit of cloud cover concentrated on that one area, those two projects will generate about 50% of our current usage, would be dangerous for our energy needs. And in terms of microgrids, we really do see distributed and decentralized energy production as being key to preventing that from happening, as well as stabilizing the grid. You know, while we're moving forward quickly as possible on these utility scale RFPs, we're also looking at microgrids, and we're looking at how we can decentralize our power. One of the hurdles to that, though, is that currently it's illegal to do what they call wheeling, which is prevents us from connecting a microgrid to HECO power lines to distribute an excess energy from that project elsewhere in the system. And so one of the things that we're trying to work on, and I know other people are working on throughout the state, is how do we edit that very old antiquated law and improve our grid overall.
Ali, did you want to add anything?
Actually, yes. I think something that I'm remembering at the triangle that Todd was talking about at the beginning of our talk around, like, the utility over here and the customer over here and the PUC over here, and how that can create some tension, and that structure has worked for a number of years the way that it has. But I also see the power in this structure that we're creating through this project, of all the motivations are aligned towards a local project that benefits and profits locally, that creates abundance, that creates accessibility into that, like, big old structure that is usually a pretty big wall between the customer and the utility. In 20 years from now, I hope that we have started to change that structure from being sort of a tent structure to the utility being driven by the people, being aligned in that. There are models for that elsewhere, but I think that the, like, granularity with which we are doing that in this project, where every decision is up for grabs, is nobody is driving that based on profit. It's based on what's best for the environment, what's best for the people, what's best for our island as a whole. And by our island, I mean Molokai. I'm not on Molokai. But yeah, I think that would be my contribution to the long-term vision.
I learned so much. I guess I just want to ask if any of you wanted to add anything before we go.
This is Auntie Laurie. I've always appreciated, you know, pushing the envelope and trying to keep these types of conversations alive for our community at the grassroots level, especially. And so I really appreciate you folks. I want to encourage you guys to makaka, keep on going, you know. I know it is difficult and, you know, we all stretched at times, but I really wanted to thank you. Mahalo plenty.
Mahalo to you. Mahalo to each of you. I'm so grateful that you folks have taken on this work. Yeah, I'm really excited for our listeners to hear, especially about that this work is happening on Molokai and then even in Waianae. I'm here on Oahu and it's so exciting that these connections are growing.
A huge thank you to Laurie Buchanan, Todd Yamashita, Christopher O'Brien, and Ali Andrews for sharing their mana'o with us and for taking on such a big and important job. That's the end of our season, but if you want to keep learning about energy justice, you can tune into a panel on community-owned energy live on Sierra Club Hawaii's Facebook page this Wednesday, June 23rd at 5 p.m. That's at www.facebook.com/Sierra Club Hawaii. Thanks to our podcast team, Carly Rizzuto, Anna Chua, and especially Lauren Ballesteros Watanabe, who's been organizing around energy justice here in Hawaii and helped make these conversations possible. We're going to be taking a break from the podcast over the summer, but please watch this space for more on environmental justice in the fall. Bye.